Hello and welcome to the Majlis, Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. This week, again, we are talking about Uzbekistan, the country which has just buried the only leader it has seen since its independence, Islam Karimov. Today in the Majlis, we are discussing today's Uzbekistan and looking into its future. As Karimov gone, what life looks like in Uzbekistan without him? What are the predictions about the days ahead? What are the prospects for change? What is the legacy he is leaving and what does it mean going forward? To discuss the subject from St. Louis, America, I have Sarah Kanzur, who is the Central Asia researcher. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Very good to have you. Steve Severdlo, Central Asia researcher with Human Rights Watch. Steve, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Alisher Siddiq, director of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Uzbek service, who is the source of most of the information we have received these days about Uzbekistan, is also joining us from Prague. Alisher, welcome
to
the show.
I'm here. Thank you.
And Bruce Panier, who is the editor of Kishlak Awazi, Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, is also with us from Prague. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being part of the Majlis today. Alisher, let's start with you. You guys reached to some interesting details about last days of Karimov. Could you please tell us more about this?
Oh, that's you mean the news with the neurosurgeon, right?
Right.
Yeah, so basically the guy gave an interview to major Finland's
He's the doctor who examined Karimov in his last days, I believe, right?
Yeah. So this doctor, actually, it was quite difficult to find him, but he gave an interview to a local Finnish news agency,
right.
Juha Hernesniemi, his name. So he's a 69-year-old veteran doctor, and he explained how he went to Uzbekistan. And the major findings, what he said, you know, is that, you know, the moment he arrived to Uzbekistan, which is apparently... we're talking either late 27th of August or 28th, early on 28th, that patient's brain was dead. So meaning that also he added that later on power game started, which that he meant by that a patient sort of undergoes sort of life supporting kind of treatment, but basically hopeless. You can unplug him any moment. So this is what we get from firsthand to Uzbekistan, and that kind of revelation basically confirms all the previous reports that Karimov first collapsed on 27th of August. He had a stroke, and that the patient was hopeless from the very beginning.
Interesting. So what is life looks like without Karimov today in Uzbekistan?
People are kind of walking around with grim faces, pilafs, you know, this traditional food of Uzbekistan, which Uzbek do for all the festivities. Also, memorials everywhere in throughout Uzbekistan, you know, in every school, institution, square, flowers, people kind of remembering. Uzbek government has announced, as you know, 3 days of mourning that finished yesterday. But sort of today, the life kind of supposed to be as usual. But again, the new government, let's say old government, also announced that they immortalize Karimov for the next 1 month. So basically, what happened is is Karimov who was kind of always opposing an idea of being a cult of personality when he was alive. After his death, his cult, I mean, there's no longer this buffer or anything to stop people to turn him into this cult. So, and the current government is really utilizing on that purpose.
Okay, thank you, Alisher. Bruce, like days leading to the announcement of Karimov's death, developments in post-Karimov era also buried in lots of secrecy. Any indication what shape the leadership is taking?
Well, I mean, Mirziyayev has been heading just about everything that goes on. He laid the flowers when it was on the eve of Independence Day. He organized the funeral. He met with Putin today. And in fact, he's been meeting with just about any officials that have been in Uzbekistan since last Saturday. So you'd have to say he's the odds-on favorite. Oppositely, Azimov, who was at the funeral, the finance minister, we saw him there at the funeral, and then we haven't seen him at all since then. The fact that Inuyatov hasn't been seen is hardly any surprise at all. It was more of a surprise they actually had photos of him from Saturday's funeral. So I'm not, I don't see anything in the fact that he's not visible in the public. He's probably still calling most of the shots from behind the scenes. But it seems like they've shoved Mirziyayev forward, and at least I would presume that he's the heir apparent at this moment.
But these messages are sent to Senate chairman. I mean, what is the contradiction here then? Okay, you are saying like PM is the in charge?
I think this is just a question of protocol. Constitutionally, Yuldashev is the head of the country at the moment, temporarily. And I think that's just Nazarbayev paying lip service to the formality of Uzbekistan's constitution, probably in the hopes that the same thing will happen when he goes. But I don't think anyone really sees Yuldashev as being the guy. Even Rosenblum, when he was there, meeting with the head of the chairman of the Senate at the moment. So yeah, formally he's in charge, and he should be calling elections very soon, I would imagine. But I think everyone just kind of looks past him. The condolence letters all go to him, but the business of state is all directed in Mirziyayev's direction so far.
Sarah, in one of your tweets, you talk about vacuum of power in Uzbekistan these days.
That there's a vacuum of power?
Yeah.
No, I don't necessarily think so. I mean, I do think that at the moment they're going to bide their time before they make that official, just based on gossip, which, as y'all know, is our central mode of communication when discussing Uzbekistan. From what I've heard, he's the most likely candidate. I've heard there may not actually be elections, even though there's, constitutionally supposed to have them. But instead, he'll be presented as kind of a people's choice, as if the people of Uzbekistan naturally on their own, decided to elevate Mirziyoyev of their own free will.
Steve, according to your information, how stable is Mirziyoyev's position?
Well, it's hard to know. I think I agree with what's been said. Mirziyoyev does appear to have the upper hand. And what I've been hearing more about is that, certainly, as with many periods in Uzbekistan's history, and many holidays, many other events of the government's paranoia at times like these, are human rights defenders, journalists, and anyone really suspected presenting any sort of threat or risk. So we've been getting information from some of our contacts that there have been intensive document searches, проверки паспортного режима, going around in Tashkent. Lots of elite families have not been left untouched by just random searches. A lot of paranoia, a lot of questions about who could present problems for the regime. So, I mean, in a way, it's normal business, the course of business in Uzbekistan for human rights defenders. But I think, there are signs the government is on high alert.
Sarah, you said like there is not an apparent power vacuum, but do you call this what is happening behind the door or in public a smooth transition of power in the country?
I think that from the beginning they've been trying to make the appearance of a smooth transition of power. This is that the government announced basically on the day that Karimov had his stroke, as confirmed by that Finnish doctor, that September 2nd was going to be a day off. And the way they presented it was a day off to recover from the excitement of the September 1st holiday. But it's, that, of course, ended up being the day that, it was announced that Karimov had passed and funeral preparations were being, underway in Samarkand. And so I think they've been pretty good to an extent about controlling the message. So I think the internet might prove a challenge into being able to keep the behind-the-scenes activities actually behind the scenes. I think they're more likely to see leaks than they have in the past. At the same time, though, you know, they are a very insular regime, as always. So, you know, everything that we're saying here is gossip. But if you kind of look over the last week, a lot of that online gossip really checked out and really proved to be true.
Alisher, the way the transition of power is taking place, is it something expected?
Yeah, I mean, the transition of power, you know, in a way that the power was always held by small group, yeah, sort of, at this point we're watching not a transition, but distribution of Karimov's power between, in this group, yeah?
Between which group?
It's, Inoyatov, of course, the chief of National Security Service, Azimov, the Minister for Finance, the guy who controls all finance, economy, banking, these sectors. Then you have Mirziyoyev, of course. Then you have Zelimkhon Haidarov. This is Karimov's chief of staff. And then a couple of other people, like central bank chief. These are the members of Security Council, basically. So now the Karimov's power was distributed among them. Huh. And the agreement is to have Mirziyoyev to lead everything. Huh. And as it happened during the Soviet times, he headed the commission to organize funerals. Huh. That means that he's like unofficially already head of state. And that's why you see President Putin coming and meeting him instead of a puppet president, you know, who is constitutional kind of temporary president. Right. Sort of the power in itself is not in any transition moment now. It's more like distributed, mm-hmm. and now they will have to decide who will kind of constitutionally take over the government and the state.
Yeah, Bruce, it appears from all of your comments that Mirziyoyev is kind of succeeding Karimov. So what would you say that the Uzbek leadership was ready for this transition?
It's something that would have been on their minds for quite some time now. I mean, we've had these scares of Karimov falling out of the public eye and rumors that he was sick before. And some of those were probably true. So it's certainly something that that they would have contemplated individually. That would have practically been considered treason to even discuss you know, government after Karimov at that point. So I think that was a lot of the problem with, you know, last week and, you know, keeping Karimov sick or, you know, alive artificially anyway for a while. Part of that would have been that they just had to, now that he was actually dead, that they understood that he was gone, they did have to all get together and discuss, okay, you know, our next move, you know, who's going to be in charge of what once the dust all settles here. It's kind of new territory for him, but at the same time, it's something that all of them would have been considering for years and years, so it's not like a total surprise. And all of a sudden, they're like, oh my God, what are we going to do? It's like, okay, the moment has finally come, and we are going to behave and act in this way, and they had to agree on that latter part about our next move, our behavior is going to be this.
Alisher, you mentioned that distribution of power is taking place. So who is handling all this? Is there any figurehead?
Yeah, of course. The most powerful person among them is the guy who controls the security, you know.
Inoyatov.
Who controls information, security, who has compromise to all of these figures. So, of course, Inoyatov here is like a old guy who tells who goes where, right? But the thing is that he also realizes that he personally cannot take over this. You know, he must appoint someone. So, and he has very good relations with Mirziyoyev. Mirziyoyev is also very good at, you know, keeping his real agenda secret for a long time. You know, he has been with Karimov for a long time. He was patient. This is his moment. Now, I don't think that he would do anything in upcoming 3, 4, 5 months that would make Inoyatov to believe that indeed Mirziyoyev, as a leader, as a chief of state, I think the first thing he would want to do is to change the National Security Service chief, who would know too much. I mean, he wouldn't want to be under his control anymore, right?
Right.
So that is like we're talking now about upcoming 6 months from now. But for time being, I don't expect any sudden moves.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, from your point of view, what is the likely scenario going forward now?
I think what Alisher just said is right. I think if there's going to be any kind of unrest or instability, it's not going to be a short-term thing. It's something that will develop over time after leadership is maybe formally decided. I think one thing that is probably happening now is that they realize, you know, while there's not actually a power vacuum, there's certainly the appearance of one to outside actors. And so I think we might have internal rivalries to, at the time being, try to get along, to present some kind of united front in order to just create that appearance of stability, which people will buy into and will maybe be a deterrent for people trying to intervene in their affairs. I think one of the real questions is how will Uzbek people accept Mirziyoyev, assuming he is the president? You know, as everyone has obviously noted, they've never known anybody but Karimov. They've never had a country without Karimov. And for all of the things Karimov did, he did, you know, create a vision of nationalism, speeches with his picture, with his slogans, you know, with all these things that were about him. And so how does that transfer onto another person? You know, how does another person have that same sense of authority or legitimacy? And will others challenge him? You know, whether that's elites within the government or, and I think this is very doubtful, Uzbek people. And I say that's doubtful because, you know, of course, the security services are still there. The general authoritarian environment is still there, and it's still extremely dangerous, you know, for people to protest or to express any kind of criticism of what's going on. But at the kind of instability, it will come further down the line instead of right now, kind of like what Alisher was saying.
Mm-hmm. Alisher, the question Sarah was raising, like, what's the view of him, Mirziyoyev, among the people? What are the feedback that that you are getting from Uzbekistan, since we almost kind of know that who is coming, stepping in to Karimov's shoes?
I think it's kind of a little Western approach to look into people's opinions. You know, people are just easily manipulated mass, right? I mean, whatever should be said, it should be said, right? Mm. They don't have a voice. They're not deciding their leader. We're not talking about elections here. We're talking about their rules of the game. We're not talking about revolution. We're talking about very natural cause of a death. I don't think they would do anything that would please people or would consider people's opinion, whatever, in this point. So that's how it looks. They would decide it. They will hold these fake some sort of elections without any decent candidate. They will present Mirziyoyev as someone who would continue Karimov's great policy to provide peace and stability in the country. That's how it will go on. I mean, it could be either constitutionally with elections, with fake elections, or unconstitutionally without any elections, as Sarah rightly pointed out. But the result is known. It's like now we kind of exactly know what the result, but we need to do some math. Right.
Can I add on this point
here?
Yeah,
please.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think what Sarah is also saying is correct. On the elections, there is a point of leverage here, though. It's an interesting, in a way, marker, because the OSCE last year issued a very damning report on the conduct of the last presidential election when Karimov reinstalled himself for a fourth term consecutively, mm-hmm. even though the Constitution only allowed him two. And, I mean, I think because it was such a strong and clear report, a lot of the criticism last time around was that there was not meaningful competition in those elections. There wasn't the opportunity for independent candidates to register. There wasn't an opportunity for any of them to really get TV time or airtime. Of course, those things seem like complete pipe dreams in Uzbekistan, but, you know, those are standards that exist.
Steve, from Alisher's point of view, the result is kind of known and PM is appearing as a prominent person. Is it a good news for Uzbekistan?
Well, what we know about Mirziyoyev is, and I remember when I was in Tashkent speaking with farmers about Mirziyoyev. He comes from Jizakh, and Bruce has written an excellent profile on him. But, you know, what we know from farmers is that Mirziyoyev was basically an enforcer in terms of making sure that cotton quotas are met across the country and that that each region is delivering the cotton quota that's required of it. He's known for his fiery temper. He's known for being, you know, a very tough personality. And I think in terms of, you know, that's obviously not a good precedent, not a good sign in terms of what we know about him. But it's also good that we have that information. Obviously, he's going to need to establish his own authority. As Sarah says, it's going to be very difficult for anybody to step into Karimov's shoes. And so, you know, I think politics does exist in Uzbekistan. Rivalries do exist. So Mirziyoyev is going to have to be somewhat to step on people's toes too quickly. On the other hand, though, he could take the view that he has to prove strength right at the outset. And, you know, some, again, as I mentioned, human rights activists are very worried that the last remnants of civil society could be wiped out in the next few months if Mirziyoyev wants to prove that he's not going to be messed with. So I think there are a lot of points where we have to watch very closely which segment of society is being affected and you know, the pressure that the regime is going to be imposing on them.
Bruce, how different is he from Karimov as a leader if he is indeed become a leader of Uzbekistan?
Well, I think you'd find the roots of that in their past. Karimov rose up through the ranks of the Communist Party, and he was a bureaucrat for a long, long time, practically his whole life. Well, not his whole life, but certainly, you know, I mean, going back into the 70s, by the time he was president, he had already been, you know, in the ranks of the Communist Party, in the leading ranks of the Communist Party in Uzbekistan for a decade and a half, pretty close, something like that. And Mirziyoyev was a local Komsomol leader, okay, but he wasn't really in the government until post-independence. And even then, you know, he was a governor starting in 1996 when he was governor of Jizakh, and later he became governor of Samarkand before he became prime minister. But he didn't have the background that Karimov had for learning, you know, the mechanics of how to govern a society and a country. Admittedly, Karimov was there to take orders from Moscow. That was true. But Mirziyoyev is so I would say that he won't have anywhere near the experience. He'll be relying heavily on someone else and on other people probably in the government to give him advice. Inuyatov probably being first and foremost among that group. Whereas Karimov, you know, until at least the last few years, Karimov really was kind of independent. He certainly was listening to what other people said. But at the end of the day, I think he would make the decisions based on what he figured was best for everybody. And he had some experience to do that. So, say at some point, he's either going to have to play somebody else's game or realize that he's part of a group and not an individual. And he just simply can't function the way that Karimov had. Sarah has mentioned that he won't have the legitimacy. Karimov had an aura. He was the first president of the country, you know, and that was his basis for legitimacy. I'm the first president of the country. Yeah. The second president of the country doesn't have that.
Sara, Alisher, this question is kind of open for both of you. Currently, Uzbekistan is facing lots of economic problems. Does the prime minister has the necessary skills to handle these problems?
I mean, I think, you know, as many have pointed out, he's planning to and has been governing in a very similar way to Karimov, which means that the economy is in disarray, migrant labor is high, unemployment is high, and opportunities for youth are low. And, you know, that's something I want to emphasize is that half of the country is under 25. And so you really have this youth struggling to have families, struggling to, you know, keep their families well fed and housed. And, you know, I think that is something that maybe is a little different. And when we're talking about differences between Karimov and Mirziyoyev in terms of, you know, how they built their political careers, I actually think it might be a little advantageous that Mirziyoyev is more disconnected from the Soviet system than Karimov, because I would guess that just by age alone, you know, and sort of life experience, he has a better understanding of, you know, maybe what young people are doing. But he might just have a better lay of the land, less of an attachment to Soviet ways, maybe a better understanding of technology or other things that might be a barrier in maintaining power over them. So I think, you know, that's something to watch out for.
I was just going to say, I think, Sarah, you're right. And if anything, I think Mirziyoyev probably will not make the same faux pas about migrant laborers that, mm-hmm. that Karimov did just a few years ago, which made him look completely out of touch.
For with Karimov, he became a sort of big kind of a godlike creature, yeah, who just simply doesn't know what's going on Earth. Yeah, and it will be very hard to sell it with Mirziyayev, you know, because he was walking on Earth. He was a representative of Karimov on Earth, let's put it this way. So he knew what's going on. He knows what's going on. He knows the real situation in economy. That will be a difficult, you know. With Karimov was kind of always, let's say, it was for him, it was very good reason not to act. He just simply doesn't know. Nobody allows the information to him, you know, like this. So, and he was always kind of innocent, you know, in whatever happens, he's innocent.
But so, this is the perception you are talking about, Alisher.
Yeah, with Mirziyayev, it's difficult to sell that. I don't know. I didn't know about it. He knows it. He runs it. He hided it from Karimov, probably part of he watches media. I'm sure.
But just to push back on that.
Yeah.
Push back on that for a second, though. I mean, I think power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. I mean, it may not take very long for Mirziyoyev, if the authoritarian system stays exactly the way it is, to become entirely detached and, you know, as Ali Sher, go up to heaven and start, you know, just...
will just replace Karimov, but for a while he would have to deal with his previous knowledge, yeah? Mm-hmm. I think so. This guy's potential is there. I mean, I keep saying this. Karimov really set the bar high for corruption, for human rights violations. So Karimov's bar is pretty high. But Mirziyoyev has that talent, really, to reach that bar and to even to set a new bar. Whenever you believe something is too bad in Uzbekistan, don't worry. It can be even worse. So this is what people say.
You're describing Karimov as a godlike creature. Since godlike creature is gone, would the people's reaction might be different in case if Prime Minister fails to deliver the expectation of people?
With people, we agreed. I mean, forget about them. You know, there's nothing like this.
But godlike creature is gone, Alisher. He's not
Karimov. No. This is, again, with people, it's just a completely different conversation. I mean, it's maybe something you want to discuss, the role of people in decision making, accountability. It's completely different topic. You know, we're talking about power, real power, you know. So the power, security wise, Inoyatov would control everything. You know, the security, it's his monopoly. You hardly can hardly can share that with anyone. Then Mirziyoyev and Azimov. Mirziyoyev runs economy, but he doesn't have an access to finance, banking. That thing he wants to grab from Azimov. Mm. So we expect that the first fight will be over banking. There, I think Mirziyoyev will try to grab the control from Azimov, and the fight, little fight, may erupt there.
No, I was trying to get into other discussion. Like, I'm talking about likelihood of protest and protest getting out of control in response to failing the meeting the expectation of people. Steve, you want to say something? Please go ahead.
Before we get to possibility or non-possibility of protests, which I think has more religious persecution of the likes of Andijan, I just wanted to mention or ask, we've been talking about the power ministries, we've been talking about the people in the inner clique, but one point I just wanted to mention is that for years now, even in conversations with some diplomats, when we try to make the point that, you know, the international community should be pushing Uzbekistan harder to reform, one of the things that you sometimes hear is that diplomats who visit Uzbekistan, they always meet with the Oli Majlis. And they, you know, in terms of, for example, pushing for changes in the cotton harvest, they meet with the ministry, the trade confederation. And one thing we often hear is there's a younger generation of politicians and bureaucrats in the Uzbek government who are waiting for their moment. That inside the Uzbek government, there are people that are somewhat reform-minded, that have grown up, who are maybe even in their mid-30s, even, you know, way younger than Mirziyoyev, who are sitting in this in the Senate chairs in the Olim Majlis, and could be people that the West could work with. And I'm just curious if anybody has any thoughts, if that's a completely naive idea, if we can expect anything to come, you know, from those elements of the government.
All right. Bruce, any idea?
No, I mean, I've certainly heard the same thing, that there are people who are relatively more reform-minded than what we've seen lately. You know, a lot of this is going to depend on how much some of them have been co-opted into the system. Is there some rewards that they get by going along with this or not? That's why, you know, it's hard. No one would want to predict how long someone like Mirziyoyev would be in power or something like that. But I really think that that with luck, he will be a transitional figure that might hold the system in place for a while. But it'll be the next guy after him that really might shake things up a little bit more, because he would have come from a different generation. You know, I suppose Karimov gets a little bit of credit for trying to bring younger people in, and certainly the biggest party, well, the most popular party, the one that has the most seats in parliament now, is one that he created specifically for youth some years back. So there is some hope that lies in that right now.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Bruce Panier.
Maybe I will just add to that, if you have time. Just one remark.
Yeah, please, briefly, and we will get into our
again,
second
when,
part.
When I was talking about the final results is known, maybe talking about Mirziyayev, we're probably talking about some other person, but the final result will be that the system is there, it will continue. So the perception of ordinary people is that the new people will come, they will have to feed themselves for a long time, so to get their billions. And then, you know, nothing will change. So
thank you, Alisher Sadiq. Just to recap the discussion today in the Majlis, Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, we are discussing post-Karim of Uzbekistan and it is possible scenarios for the future. Discussing the subject with me are Sarah Kanzinur, journalist and Central Asia researcher, Steve Sivertlo, Central Asia researcher with Human Rights Watch, Bruce Panier, Central Asia blogger with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis. So in this part of the Majlis, let's dwell a little bit about the likely future of the Uzbek government and its implication to the region and regional approach towards a post-Karimov era. To begin with Moscow, Russians seems suddenly become very active, Sarah. Putin was in Samarkand meeting Prime Minister and also Karimov's family. What Russians are up to there these days?
Well, there is a transcript of, you know, some of the conversation between Putin and Mirziyoyev that happened today that I thought was very interesting. I felt like both of them were being very savvy. Putin, of course, was presenting Russia as, you know, their best and most reliable ally. You know, he was expressing his mourning for Karimov and praising Karimov, you know, while saying that, you know, he hopes that Karimov's great policies continue. Mirziyoyev was similarly expressing gratitude to Russia. I do think that this will push Uzbekistan even closer to Russia, although, of course, there's that interdependency anyway due to, you know, economic ties and migrant labor. You know, as Steve was kind of mentioning, an economic-based unrest, if there's going to be any unrest at all, related in part to the remittance issue in the migrant economy, which affects both Russia and Uzbekistan.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, first, your thoughts on Putin's visit to Central Asia, and also during that visit, I have seen a picture in which he was meeting with Karimov's family. Does it say anything significant?
Well, the symbolism will be won't be lost on the population, that's for sure. I mean, he's the president of Russia. He showed up to pay his respects, you know, gave his condolences to the family. So clearly they'll be reminding people Putin actually showed up, you know, and came here. It says something. It will say something to the people of Uzbekistan, too. So as far as what the government and officials, even Mirziyoyev, was saying, I mean, I saw some of what they were saying, too, and it was a lot of their statements were like, you know, Russia has been, is, and will be a partner, but we know that they haven't been a very strong partner, you know, at times during the last 25 years. So, you know, this business of, like, we've been together and we've gone through all this stuff, you can read that a lot of ways. You know, does that mean that everyone's happy with what it's been like for the last, you know, 10 years? It's pretty hard to say, but certainly the symbolic value of Putin actually showing up and visiting the gravesite of Karimov won't be lost on anybody in Uzbekistan, first and foremost the people of the country.
Alisher, it looks like Mirziyoyev is the clearly person of choice for Russia. Is it your reading?
Yes, there are family relations which are very important in Central Asia. Names like Diora and Bobur, that might not say much for many people. Bobur is the favorite nephew of Alisher Usmanov, a Russian oligarch of Uzbek descent. So very close to Putin, the richest guy in Russia, and who supposed to leave all his wealth to Bobur. And Bobur is married to Diora, who is the nephew of Shavkat Mirziyoyev. Unfortunately, very sad, Bobur died in 2009, tragically in Tashkent. But nevertheless, the relations between Alisher Usmanov and Mirziyoyev remained very good, you know, stable. So there are also economic interests, family interests. So for so many years, all these ties got intertwined. And Shavkat Mirziyoyev would be very good to for Russia, you know. And we saw that from the happy faces of Putin and Mirziyoyev meeting together. So as it would be very big guest, yeah, the whole ceremony was reorganized from the scratch. Flowers again were brought to Karimov's grave. Lola, the daughter of president, the wife of President Tatiana, was brought back to Samarkand again to see Putin. So, in fact, Putin was the solo hero, the big guest.
If I could just jump in for a second, too, and mention something that, you know, it seemed like Karimov was really the one that had kind of, he was real apprehensive about a Russian policy. But we've been talking about Inuyata being, you know, something that the great cardinal in Uzbekistan. And Inuyata is a veteran KGB guy from the Soviet era. And no matter what Uzbek-Russian ties have been like, the ties between the SNB in Uzbekistan and the FSB in Russia have always been good. And Steve would know a bunch about that. So Inuyata's policy, if he's really the gray cardinal and calling the shots toward Russia, will probably be a lot more favorable than Islam Karimov's policy was toward Russia.
And just one more point, you know, maybe my final point for today, I don't know. You know, who America sent for the funeral? It was, of course, Daniel Rosenblum.
Was he for the funeral?
Yeah, he was there for the visit of the grave. He could not attend the funeral per se because, you know, like it's an Islamic, Muslim type of funerals. But the thing is, and in Russia's case, we have a Putin visiting personally. Yeah. So that shows how different those interests are. It's very important message in Uzbekistan. It was supposed to be John Kerry visiting Uzbekistan. Then the time to press for interests in Uzbekistan. This is the time to learn about the specific characteristics of Mirziyoyev, his strong, his weak points, how you can get in touch with him, how you can build the relations with him, because you're going to build relations with a person, not with the state, not with the, with the institution, with a person in this case. So, and then after 5-10 years, we will see again these complaints from Washington, we're losing. Russia have a lot of influence on Uzbekistan. Right, they will have a lot of influence on Uzbekistan because you do nothing. You're sending a different person. You're sending not the exact person that has to be sent now. It shows either there is no interest, and for the future, I think nobody should complain if Uzbekistan goes to Russia.
Maybe there is no interest, or maybe what Steve was saying earlier, that the Western leaders are trying to give message to Uzbekistan by playing low.
Well, of course, the U.S. ambassador was pictured there standing next to the leaders holding her own. But, you know, I think Ali Sher makes a good point about the Obama administration throughout, you know, the last 8 years taking, let's say, a very mellow, shall we say, disengaged posture on what's happening in Uzbekistan. But in a way, I have to say, I was sort of relieved that Kerry didn't show up at the funeral and that he didn't, in a way, participate in the fawning Karimov, because I think in some way it is necessary to make a break with that past and to send a different message. Of course, Washington should be engaging, but how should it engage? I think what needs to happen right now, should happen this minute, is that the EU and the United States should put conditions on the table, put their expectations on the table, make them known for everyone to hear, and raise those expectations in the UN, raise those expectations in bilateral meetings, but also in public statements, that the least we should expect from a transitional government towards living up to international obligations. And those things would be relatively easy for Mirziyoyev or the transitional government to do, which would be to release political prisoners, to allow the UN human rights experts who monitor torture and other abuses into the country, because Uzbekistan hasn't allowed a single one since 2002 to even visit Uzbekistan. It would be to allow the Red Cross back into Uzbek prisons, allow civil society in Uzbekistan to basically just resume its functioning, and of course change their practices on the cotton harvest. That may sound like a tall order, but I mean, these are expectations that Karimov knew about and Mirziyoyev doubtlessly knows about. So it's something that I think, whether or not Kerry goes there soon,
why would you think that Uzbekistan, independent state for the past 25 years, would want to meet any expectations from the other side of the pond?
Yeah, is it okay if I just cut in on this? You know, agree with everything that Steve was saying. I think these are all very good suggestions, but I think what Alisher is saying is absolutely right, that there is very little indication that now, of all times, when they're trying to maintain this atmosphere of stability and security and power and legitimacy, that they're going to follow through on anything that a Western country is going to demand. And then just one more quick thing, like, what's going on in America right now is also important. You know, since we've withdrawn from Afghanistan, Uzbekistan has really kind of fallen off the radar for American interests. I mean, obviously, it's back on a bit now because of, you know, we have had two fairly disastrous wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. We have an economy that's badly ailing. We have an absolutely ridiculous presidential election, you know, just that's causing all sorts of internal conflicts and hostilities. And I think kind of the last thing on anybody's mind in D.C. is Uzbekistan. And I see lots of, you know, Russian outlets and stuff saying, oh, America's getting ready to intervene. It's like America can't even handle its own problems right now. Uzbekistan has zero interest in America having any kind of input in what's going to happen. So I think this might be one of these things where, I agree to say, oh, you know, we're mourning Karimov, he was so great. I mean, that was good, but I think it came from more of a lack of interest in a huge number of distractions than any kind of well-thought-out power play regarding Uzbekistan.
Steve, when a king in Saudi dies, they actually go there.
I think we should give an opportunity for Steve to respond. Steve?
No, I mean, my point is that the U.S. and the EU have more leverage than they often believe they do. And I think, you know, I think Mirziyoyev will need the leverage point that's been very important for Karimov. As Bruce mentioned, you know, Karimov was always trying to play the U.S. off of Russia in terms of military power, and military assistance is something that the Uzbek government is going to want. And I think the U.S. should be very clear about attaching conditions to the provision of military assistance, of lethal equipment. So, I mean, yes, of course, this is a hardened regime which is used to thumbing its nose at the international community. And certainly there's no Uzbek constituency in American politics that's pushing the administration. Have seen that when the international community has gotten tough with Uzbekistan, which it did after Andijan, there were results. There were releases. There were opportunities for a slight opening or at least a non-worsening of the situation. I think this is a moment of opportunity. So diplomats who are schooled in how to negotiate and leverage their own interests should be looking at this as a moment to push. And they won't get everything they want, but they could get something. They could get, for example, the release very soon, I hope, of the world's longest imprisoned journalist whose term is set to expire, be raising those conditions. And that's quite simply, I think that's something that if it's actually talking or thinking about long-term interests in the region and forming some sort of lasting relationship with the Uzbek people, not the government, it should be doing those things.
Interesting, Steve, you said moment of opportunity for international powers. And also, Bruce, this situation gives a moment of opportunity for Uzbekistan's own leadership. What kind of opportunity does it present?
Well, you know, Berdy Muhammadov is a good example in Turkmenistan.
Right, yeah.
Niyazov was an isolationist, but Berdy Muhammadov came to power. And one of the first things he said was, I'm going to get better ties with my neighbors. And he did. You know, I mean, ties with the Turkmenistan's ties with all its neighbors are much better than they were under Niyazov. The new guy could probably do something along the same lines. You know, his problem is that the Uzbek government's posturing toward Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan has been fairly aggressive. It's going to be hard for a new leader to he won't want to look like he's soft or weak on certain positions. It makes him look bad and gives other people the idea they can push him around. But I would start there. I would try to find out how they can improve relations regionally, because they're more powerful together in the region than they are split up like they are now. I mean, Russia and China and other people just pick away at them because they've got them all separated. If they could do something to have better ties with and since Uzbekistan borders all the Central Asian countries, it would help them a lot. I hear what Steve is saying, and I'm with him 100% on, you know, what U.S. policy and Western policy should be, is recognizing what is Uzbekistan really worth in the long run to them. What do we get out of this? It'd be good to have friends and partners there, but how much can you ignore? What of your own values are you willing to scrap just for the sake of being able to say these are our friends and partners in Central Asia?
Right. Final question. What message do the regional leaders are taking from this change in Uzbekistan? Sara, any opinion?
Well, I'm sure they're watching very closely in Kazakhstan and Tajikistan in particular to see how this transition plays out. What they're learning is how to, you know, try to at least maintain a facade of unified power. I think they've somewhat managed to do that, although the leaks surrounding the timing of Krimov's death, and I have to break in and say if Krimov had not died right before Independence Day, I'm not sure all these leaks would have happened, because I think they would have, you know, tried to keep the story under wraps for longer, you know, kind of shows some of the weaknesses. If there's another transition of power similar to Turkmenistan, then I think, you know, then you can kind of see there is a pattern. We've been able to discern a pattern before because the leaders have stayed in power for so long. But if Uzbekistan ends up emulating Turkmenistan's path, you know, I think that that's possibly a sign this will play out in Tajikistan and Kazakhstan as well. Kyrgyzstan, as we know, is a very different case, much more restive, much more likely to have, you know, uprisings and changes of power.
Thank you. Thank you, Sara Kanzinur, journalist and Central Asia researcher. Steve Sivertlou, Central Asia researcher with Human Rights Watch. Bruce Panier, Central Asia blogger with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Alisher Siddiq, director of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Uzbekistan desk. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your participation in the Majlis today.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis. Hope to meet you in the Majlis next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.